everyone. I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Well, howdy do, Brian.
Hey, Brandon. What's up?
I'm just excited to be here. And here is a guestless episode. You know, it's December. Everyone's busy, except us. We don't have lives. You gentle listeners are our life. And I guess our families. Brian got a new cat. This is now the Critical Care Cat podcast.
Yeah, let's get important stuff out of the way first, right?
He's orange. Household. His name is Tigger. Mm-hmm. And he's not getting along with their previous animals. So Tune in next week for updates.
Right. This is good podcasting right here. This is the constant updates of my animals.
Yeah, people want to know this stuff, man. I certainly do.
Yeah, it was a surprise. We just sort of decided to get a cat randomly.
No, that's always how it is. The cats make the decision.
Yeah.
There's a big schedule somewhere in Cat HQ.
Yeah. I would like to say, he's not making friends well right now with the other animals, but he is very comfortable and confident in himself and his environment. He has found a spot, and he seems to have said, this is a suitable home. I will take it.
Yep, that's cats for you.
And I think he's now in charge.
We could all learn from their self-assuredness.
Yeah, absolutely.
Perhaps we could also learn from this week's episode, which is going to be a grab bag of mini micro pico cases, really just situations. We want to take a look at the general theme of what do you do when it all goes wrong? What's our approach and our framework for kind of troubleshooting or responding to glitches in the matrix, or really when kind of our plan A or routine approach to things is not panning out, which, you know, I think is one of the most important things that we learn, especially at kind of the journeyman level of medicine. You know, the first part is kind of building your initial approach to many things, whether that's how you treat a disease or how you do a procedure, how you respond to a certain situation, you know, what's your go-to? But of course, those things don't always work. And developing a little bit of a depth to your bench, you know, a plan B and C and knowing what to do then is kind of the next step. Because if all you have is your first line, then you have kind of a brittle framework, if that's the word, you know. All you can do is your first thing, and then hope that it never goes wrong or fails you, and it may usually work. It may work 95% of the time, but what are you going to do the rest of the time? Even if your plan B is to, you know, call somebody for help, I mean, you need some kind of a plan B.
Yeah, I think this is a good thing to talk about, because I do think this is something that I unfortunately see a lot in novice practitioners, but even a lot in experienced people. And I say all the time, hope is not a plan, right? So plan B cannot be, I hope that plan A works. And this is something that was drilled into me in training early on, is to always have a plan B and probably a plan C and a plan D as well.
And a lot of the time, this doesn't have to be particularly exciting stuff. You just need to have some kind of an approach. So
yeah.
Let's just rattle through a few situations and sort of see what our approach is. Let's maybe start with some procedural things, because this is, you know, a not uncommon time when things might challenge you. And, you know, to call a procedure difficult or challenging in our world, everyone has kind of a different threshold for. But, you know, these are sick, complicated patients. It's not uncommon that things get a little weird. Like, your absolute basic approach to something is a little bit gnarly. And, you know, I think we get so used to that, we walk out and didn't even strike you as unusual, but to someone who's like learning, you know, that particular challenge might have been baffling until you, again, develop something of an approach. So a few situations, let's see. Let's say you are performing a Seldinger approach to some sort of vascular access, maybe a central line, an arterial line, And you've inserted your needle, you've gotten a nice flash, you know you're in a vessel, and you're trying to insert your guide wire, and your wire won't go. You're trying to pass it, and it just won't really insert. What's your first reaction to this?
Well, when I was new, my first reaction was, maybe I need to push a little harder. Yeah. but I've since learned that that's rarely a good idea.
This is a deficiency of effort.
Yeah. Yeah, just push harder and it'll all go better. No,
I will say that you can need a little bit of effort sometimes. Usually that's like a central line, and it's usually like your wire is just banking off the back wall of the vessel because you're coming in at an angle.
Yep.
There's always a bit of a bend there. And it's, you know, it's a J that has to kind of make the curve. So a little bit of resistance, and it's hard to tell people how much is too much or too little. But more is not usually better. And for, I would say in arteries, pretty much the right amount of resistance is zero.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, joking aside, I do think that there is with specifically with central lines, not just with the wire, but with the, you know, the catheter won't go, the dilator won't go, all these things, right? There is a certain amount of force needed, which is difficult to put into words. And so I think that it's the thing that makes learning these procedures tough because you go, your learner will say, I'm getting some resistance. Well, how much resistance? I don't know. I mean, how do you quantify that? Because you're going to get some, right? You're going to have to push a little bit hard. Well, am I pushing too hard or not hard enough? You know, it's really tough to say. But let's say, assuming that's not the case, the wire won't go. My thing is generally, we'll withdraw the wire. And the first thing I do is withdraw the wire and look at the wire. Is the wire deformed now? Like, did it get kinked and messed up? In which case, not only might I need a new wire, I might be able to salvage it, but it tells me a little bit more than a perfectly normal wire. Perfectly normal wire that won't advance, okay, that's one thing. But if it's deformed, well, that means I'm really pushing hard against something that's causing the wire to bend. Either way, take the wire out, and then my approach would be to readjust my needle. Sometimes it's the angle of the needle. Like you said, it's, you know, tough making a turn or whatever. But like readjusting that angle sometimes to see if blood still flows will sometimes tell you if you're truly in the lumen or if you're sort of semi in the lumen, right? So sometimes you'll be like enough where, you know, if you go in at a steep angle, the bevel is up, it gets into the lumen and blood flows, but then when you flatten it out, you're not all the way in the vessel, right? So now it's up against the top wall or something, and maybe that's why your wire wasn't going. So maybe you need to go in a little deeper, out a little bit, whatever. Adjust it to where I get good free-flowing blood, and then I'll try again.
Yeah, I think what you need to decide is this good or bad resistance? And that comes down to somewhat how firm it is, but probably more than anything, how deep it is. Mm-hmm. Because how deep it is will tell you what sort of problem it might be. The first point you may hit resistance is when your wire is leaving the tip of your needle. And knowing how deep that is, I mean, there's a certain distance to the needle, but you don't need to memorize how long your needles are. Just kind of pin where your resistance is, take your wire out, lay it down kind of next to your needle, and you can get an idea. Is this right about where your needle was kind of entering the vessel, or is it substantially farther? It should never be less unless there's like something
you
inside
have a
your needle.
Issue, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. If it's resistance at the point where it's leaving the needle, then there's something wrong with your needle in the vessel. And usually that's because it's not actually in the vessel. You had it, but you lost it, or something like that. Sometimes it's that it's right, it's in the lumen, but it's right up against something. It's either right up against the deep wall, or you're right on the edge and it's hitting the sidewall, something like that. For all of those, the move is take out your wire. I always put a syringe back on the needle if you're going to adjust the position. That's your continuous feedback of where it is. And like you said, adjust your position. Grab the ultrasound, really put it, you know, maybe back in the vessel, put it right in the center. Right in the center there, and maybe flatten out your angle while you're doing that. If the resistance is a lot farther and you're confident that you are in that vessel, then it's usually some problem of the vessel. And that's either your wire went the wrong way, so it didn't follow your desired path kind of towards the heart, and it may be deviating to some other vessel, usually a smaller one. So that's why you're at like 10, 15, 20 centimeters, and now it's hitting resistance. Well, it's because your wire is in the arm or something, or mm-hmm. one of the IJs. That's generally what that is. Or you hit some vascular abnormality, some stenosis or occlusion somewhere. And, you know, what do you do with that? You can push through it sometimes. I don't always know, like, what are you pushing through?
Yeah.
Usually, I think it's, you know, you're in the wrong spot. You could try to confirm it with echo or something, or shoot an x-ray even during the procedure. The best way to troubleshoot this, I think, is to get your little angiocath, your kind of IV catheter over a needle that's in most central line kits. This is assuming you're doing a central line. Take it off the needle. Just run it over your wire. So now you have a non-traumatic, reliable something holding your place in the vessel. And now you can take your wire totally out, and you can futz around. You can kind of adjust how you feed it, so maybe it'll go somewhere different, things like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was sort of assuming that you meant you were getting resistance right away. But yeah, getting resistance down deeper is a much more frustrating problem because you don't really know what's going on. So yeah, adjusting your angle, adjusting sort of how you feed the wire, remembering the curvature of the wire, you know, it's coiled up in a loop there. And so it's naturally going to curve a little bit towards that bent. If you turn your wire and feed it in such a way where it's likely to curve in that direction anatomically, it helps too. So I think one of the tricky things is doing left IJs, and curving it up, necklacing the patient and getting it into the right IJ instead of dropping down into the IVC. You know, so if you adjust your wire, like flip it over to where the curve naturally is going to want to curve to the left. So as it goes into the IJ, it's going to curve down into the IVC instead of up into the right IJ. That's helpful.
Yeah, we talk a little more about this in some of the procedural stuff we did in the Intensive Care Academy. But I always sort of try to use the J-tip of a guide wire to steer. It's not as good as, you know, doing it under fluoro and IR. But you can use your that angle to make some kind of aiming. So it's blind, right? But I always start with my J facing towards the sky to bounce off the back of the vessel. And then if you need to make turns, I aim it that way. So after it leaves the needle more or less for left IJ, I turn it to the right so it comes to the right and not like into the left arm or something. And then very shortly after, I turn 180 degrees towards the heart so it hopefully goes towards the SVC and not up the right IJ. Is this a guaranteed? No, but you know, if you could try. okay, what if you're doing an arterial line, let's say like a radial, and it looks like on ultrasound you're in the vessel, but it will not flash blood for you. You're like looking at it, you're like, man, that looks like it's in that artery, but no blood is coming out.
Yeah, that's another common problem, I think. So one thing that I do when I place radial art lines is, you know, I identify the artery, right, with a little bit of compression to see if I get that pulsatility. But if I don't get a lot of pulsatility, I'll throw color on. And just make sure there's some flow. So remember, you know, the color Doppler is not going to be accurate in terms of measuring directionality of flow at this point because you're going perpendicular to the beam as opposed to parallel. But you should get color if there's flow, right? There should be something showing up on the Doppler. And if there's not, then you probably have very poor pulsatility. So in that case, you might not get a lot of flashback because you're not getting as much pressure there as you would if you had full flow, which probably means it's not a great place to put an art line anyway, because if you're not getting full flow and good pulsatility, is your pressure going to be accurate? Maybe, maybe not, right? But that's the first thing. So I sort of try and do that if it looks like it's not a great target anyway. But yeah, like if you don't get flashback, but you're clearly in the spot, a lot of times I'll just go ahead and advance the wire. I use the built-in arrow with the wire in the thing. So advance the wire and then slide the catheter off the needle tip and then pull everything out and see, do I get blood back? Because if I do, maybe I'm in there and for some reason it just wasn't doing it. You know, whether, like I said, it's poor flow or I've stuck a couple of times and there's trauma to the vessel / there is blood maybe gumping up the works inside. But now I get flow and I can see if it looks arterial or not. If I don't get flow back at that point, probably just take it out and start over.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, 90%, if it's not giving you blood, you're not in the lumen. But it, yeah, occasionally it just doesn't. I think it probably is like it's a little bit of something plugged up the lumen of your device, or you were testing or playing with the guide wire and you didn't retract it all the way. Because if it is not completely retracted, it will not flash with blood. It will, even a little bit advanced. That is a really common pitfall. But yeah, occasionally that happens. I think probably make sure you have a lumen, right? And you could even if you're not comfortable with Doppler, you can usually appreciate this even just on like B-mode ultrasound, because you could see not only is the vessel itself very small or whatever, but of the circle of vessel that's there, how much of it is lumen and how much is vessel wall? And sometimes it's like all wall or it's all something that's not lumen. And sometimes it's like a thrombus. But more commonly, especially when people are learning, especially when this comes up, not when you first looked at the vessel, but after you've been poking it, it's that it spasmed. You poke the vessel some, and arteries are very vasoactive, so now it clamped down, and there may be essentially no lumen to that vessel right now, and that's why even though you're kind of fishing around within the space of that vessel, there's no blood flow, because you're not in an actual vessel lumen. I mean, if you'd gotten in there already, you could probably, your catheter would kind of hold your spot, but you're not going to get in there now. When there's still a kind of nice lumen there, and you think you're in, but you're not, usually it's just that you're not in. You know, you're like tenting the near edge of the intima, the lumen of the vessel, but you haven't like actually broken free of it. This may be a little more common for veins, but it happens. I mean, it may really look like your tip is in the vessel, but you're really just, you've like caught that wall and it's coming with you. You haven't actually opened up the door. You're just like leaning against it. And what do you do? I just keep advancing, you know? You're never close enough that you can stop incrementally guiding your tip into the vessel. You need to do that until you have your flow and you're in. So keep kind of marching along. And if it looks like you're approaching the back wall, then flatten out your angles so you're less likely to hit that. And then maybe you kind of at some point pop through.
Yeah, I will say a couple of points about the catheter that I just described. And if you're not using this type of catheter, it's a little different. But if you're using what I think is pretty common, what I call the Arrow catheter, right? It's got the...
Yeah, Arrow makes the most common. It's a Seldinger with a retained...
Yeah, it's got the retained wire in it. So one thing that I see novices making this mistake a lot is the wire advances easily. You know, like, oh, I didn't get flash, but let's see if the wire goes. Right? The wire advances so easily, it's got to be in the vessel, right? Like, I'm getting a little resistance here. But, you know, it went so well so far. So remember, there's a black line on the catheter that until the back of the wire, where the little slidey part is, crosses that black line, you're not actually out of the needle yet. So you're advancing and it's going super smooth. Of course it is, because it's still within the catheter. And then I hit the black line and I get a little resistance. You're clearly not in the vessel, yeah, right? Because now the wire is trying to come out and it's not. So if you think that, oh, it went great until the end and then I got a little resistance, no, that's when it starts. That's the beginning of things, right?
Just like we were saying about for like a central line, you're never going to have resistance until you leave your needle, and right, that's when it happens.
And I think that sometimes throws people off because they think, oh, it went so well, and then suddenly it didn't, kind of at the end, right? No, at the very beginning when the wire's coming out. And sometimes those arrows are, I have found, and then maybe this is unique to my patient population, but a lot of times I do get that tenting because it's not quite sharp enough to really poke through a real like crunchy artery, right? So these people that have a calcification or some arteriosclerosis or something, it's not quite enough. You got to give it a little oomph to get through. And so you'll see it sometimes on the ultrasound, that tenting, and you think you're through, but just push a little harder and you'll feel that pop and then blood will come back.
Yeah, a little kind of brisk popping pressure sometimes helps. Sometimes I give a little bit of a twist. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to accept that you will go through the back wall when you finally go, and you have to just retract.
Yeah, and that's okay.
There. Yeah, some people do that intentionally. I think that's a little bit weak, but yeah, it may be unavoidable.
Yeah.
We should say, for kind of responsibility's sake, that When we talk about retracting wires, you have to be a bit cautious. If you ever have a guide wire that is through a needle, it has come out, most authorities would say you should probably not pull it back out your needle. Because the tip of these needles are sharp, they usually have a cutting edge, and if there's any bend in your wire, it could shear it off with the tip of your needle. Is this common? No. Is it possible? Yeah. And the time when it would happen is when your wire is bent, generally, when there is some sort of a kink in it. And if we're being honest, if you're a learner, when you're messing around with stuff like this, that's very likely. This is the situation when that happens. So I will not say that you should never retract a guide wire through a needle, but I will say that you should do it very cautiously. And if there is any resistance to it, you should stop and then just take out the needle with it, the entire apparatus. Yeah, that's the safe maneuver.
One other thing I will say that you can do, although I think this is really tricky. People teach it like it's a simple skill, but I think it's a really complicated skill. If you think you're in the vessel and you're not getting blood, you can rotate your ultrasound probe 90 degrees and look at things in long axis. And long axis, if you can get it, is a lot easier to appreciate if you're truly in the vessel or not. And I say if you can get it because the problem with long axis, especially on a radial artery, is you're dealing with a very narrow needle, a very narrow vessel, and an extremely narrow ultrasound plane. And all three of those things have to line up perfectly for you to see things. If you can do it, it looks great, right? You get this longitudinal cross-section, nice rectangular vessel across the entire width of the screen, needle coming down and clearly in the vessel. And then if you can manipulate it, I can't because I don't have three hands. You can hold the probe, hold your needle, and advance your wire simultaneously. You can watch the wire in real time go into the vessel, and it's really nice, and you know you're in. But it's really easy to say and describe. It's really tough to do.
Yeah, that's why we don't really recommend using that in plain view for your kind of primary guidance for a lot of these, even though it makes sense in some ways and some people like it. It's just, it's harder than it sounds, especially for like a radial artery, which is so narrow. But it can be good for troubleshooting or to see kind of after, you know, if sometimes the guide wire lays against the, you know, the deep wall of the vessel and it's hard to see if you kind of kind of blot it with your finger. It sometimes kind of bounces and is a little bit more clear. This is also maybe an argument, though, for if you're having trouble with, let's say, a radial arterial line, not using one of those devices, which are convenient but not the most kind of robust for something difficult. A kind of true Seldinger technique might be more appealing with a regular needle that you can, for instance, aspirate on, which will give you much more reliable flash when you really are in a lumen, and a free wire that gives you more options for messing with it. Now, do you have a device like that? You may or may not. One thing you may have is a micropuncture kit, which is a good way to start these, and you can just take the catheter off one of those little aero devices, railroad it over your micro wire if you started it with the micropuncture. Or you could potentially leave a micropuncture sheath as your arterial line if that's your thing. But okay, let's see. Let's talk airways. Let's say you're intubating. Now, a lot of the time we're using video now, and do you guys use the GlideScope or like a hyperangulated device for a lot of your video intubations?
We do use the GlideScope. We have, I don't always use the hyperangulated blade. Sometimes I'll just use a regular Mac blade for the Glide. But I've started using the Glide more and more, even if I use it as a DL, right? I can still look visually. It's just handy to have as a backup. I've kind of come around to this. I used to get really kind of, pretentious about it and say, like, I don't need video. I'm really good at DL. And that's fine. I can be really good at DL and still use video. Somebody pointed out, but I'm really good at blind sticks, but I still use the ultrasound.
Yeah, right? Why make your life harder? Person thing, trying to preserve your old. But when you do have like regular geometry video scopes, then it's fine. You could do either one. But there are no small number of places that primarily or only have hyperangulated blades for their video devices, and then you have to learn this whole different technique. And the challenge of video laryngoscopy is that you always have a good view of the glottis, but it can be hard to actually deliver your tube into that hole. So let's say that you have your view, you've introduced your tube over, a hyperangulated stylet, and now you're having trouble feeding the tube off a stylet into the glottis. What are your maneuvers?
Yeah, this is my biggest problem with the hyperangulated stylet. I think they're great for getting, like you said, around that if you're using the hyperangulated blade. But then they're really not so well designed for actually getting the tube through the cords, right? It gets you to the cords, but then when you push the tube off, you're pushing up instead of forward, which is what you want to push, right? So what I usually do is get the tube, the tip between the cords, and then have an assistant withdraw the stylet just a little, right? Because now it comes out, it's still holding the tube rigid. If you take it out all the way, the tube is now floppy and it's hard to advance. It's still holding it rigid, but you've done two things. You've made the tip a little floppy, but also by pulling back, you've gone from a J to now your tip of it is pointed more straightforward because you're backing up, changing the direction that the tip of the stylet's pointing more towards the cords. And I find that that's a little more helpful. And then usually as I advance off, I will kind of twist it through. And I think that helps to sort of usually, I don't think it matters. I usually typically go clockwise. I think it's because I'm right-handed. I've never really thought about it. But just kind of twisting off and advancing through.
Yeah, and we should say this is not necessarily some fancy thing. If you're doing hyperangulated video, you kind of must do this. You can't, in anyone who's not some bizarre, crazy, like Android anatomy, like actually push the tube all the way into the trachea on the stylet, because you will put it through the anterior wall of the trachea. It is just too steep of an angle.
Right.
You can get to the door, but you like cannot walk through it. So yeah, the standard move is you take the stylet out a little, you know, a couple inches. And if you're not real fancy, yeah, I would just always have an assistant do that. But if you're a little fancy, you could maybe do it yourself. If you hold the tube right at the connector there, you can usually pop it with your thumb. It takes a little thumb power. But yeah, if you're still hanging up, you know, rotation helps. Often you can get kind of wedged against the tracheal ring sometimes if you really pushed into the front. You got to kind of pull it back a smidge to liberate it. And then, turning clockwise, I think, tends to work best. So the bevel, that tube, is not stuck in there. Mm-hmm. And you can rotate as much as 180 degrees. So it's actually the natural curve of the tube has turned around and is you know, it's still partially bent forward on the stylet, but once the part that's off the stylet is now bending backwards. I've even heard people loading their tubes on backwards so that as soon as it comes off, it's snaking posteriorly. I wouldn't say it's something I do routinely, but there is an option there. Well, you can rotate the stylet too. You could kind of turn everything with it.
Yeah.
If you're finding this is like a common thing for you, this is not some freakish thing. This is like the challenge of hyperangulated video laryngoscopy. It's tube delivery. Nobody has a problem getting a view.
Right.
Unlike DL, because then they're the same. Because right. You have to line up all the axes so you could see the glottis. And if you can, then you have a straight shot there and there's no problem putting a tube there.
Yeah.
But with video, it's separate. You've just kind of put a camera around a corner so you can look at it, but that doesn't mean you can guide anything else there. It's like you have a great view of your own failings. So
right. Well, and this is, I guess, tough to describe on an audio podcast, but like you said, you're looking around the corner, and I like this analogy. Like you're looking around the corner, but instead of like I'm looking out around the corner to go down the hallway, I'm looking around the corner to the door on the opposite side of the hallway and trying to get in that room, right? So it's not I'm looking around and straight shot down the hallway, but now I need to turn again.
Yeah, two turns. Yeah. So with VL, you would just force those to be straight.
Right.
With video, you say no, leave them where they are.
Exactly.
I'll just go around them with like a little
exactly
like,
with what right? Because my yeah, stylet only goes
like
straight.
A fishing rod. Yeah.
Yeah, and now I have to somehow make it go around the second curve.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, this is not like what do you do if this happens to you? It's what do you do when this happens? Because it will happen
right.
to you.
Right, yeah. It's just like, back talking about lines and stuff. People are like, you know, I have trouble seeing my needle on ultrasound. Yeah, you do. That's the procedure.
Right.
That's the thing.
That's a feature,
not like, when you know that, you know the procedure. Everything else is just like, you know, how do you unpeel the package or whatever.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Okay, one more procedural thing. You are doing a subclavian central line.
Okay.
And you drop some air in your syringe. And you're like, I think I got a lung. Now what?
Well, that's bad. You don't really want to do that.
So now castigate yourself.
Yeah. You go, crap.
Blame your assistant.
Yeah, you say, can someone get me a chest tube tray, please? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is... I've never really had this happen to me, but it's a realistic concern.
Yeah, I've had a single one. Of course, it's always possible. I think you have to reflect on... Well, so you're in the middle of this procedure. What do? I think you can... You can finish your line if you think you can do it in a few minutes. This is not the learner doing their first subclavian. It's going to take another hour because you need to kind of get to some other things here. But you could maybe get it done. Now, if you're doing it under ultrasound, you may lose your view because air, including like sub-Q air, could be a barrier to that. But you could try to get that done. Now, I think if you reflect on the risk that this is going to tension, right, you got to get an x-ray. So you can use that for your line, too, if you got it in, or if you boarded it, then just shoot it. And if it's really small and the patient's not on positive pressure, then maybe you watch it, just like you would for any small pneumo. Repeat an x-ray soon. If it's anything but very small, and if they are on positive pressure, certainly on the vent, and probably on, like, non-invasive, unless you, like, can get them off it right now, then I think you probably need a chest tube. These are not like otherwise well patients who can tolerate a little trial of tension physiology. I mean, this is the ICU usually, so yeah. I think you have to be fairly aggressive with managing this stuff. And the rate is high of these growing in people who are on positive pressure and stuff like that. The one that I had was a vented patient. I was using a micropuncture needle, and it did still blow up after. I think you just kind of have to. I mean, certainly you can't just ignore that it happened. Like, oh, I'm sure that was normal air. That was probably in the vessel.
Right, yeah. Intravascular air. I mean, I guess on the plus side, you're draped and prepped right over the collarbone. So you just take your needle that you were using, just move it up and...
Certainly if they start to, like, decompensate anytime after, you...
And you're still sterile, so just, great, now let's continue.
Yeah, you have a plan A, which should be you have a variety of needles available to you. And, you know, if you do chest tubes, then of course you can do that, but not everyone who does lines does chest tubes, so... Okay, let's look at some non-procedural things. Here's a not uncommon one. You got a hypotensive patient, and you put them on vasopressors... Probably this is something like sepsis. You think it's a distributive shock. But you have them on pressors, and now you're cranking up your pressor dose. Maybe you're on something like norepinephrine, and it's not really working, which is to say their blood pressure response is sort of transient, and they really keeps kind of plummeting, or it really just doesn't seem to have any response. How do you think about this?
So I think my first step would be to see, well, I mean, first step obviously is to sort of stabilize things. If I can do it with fluid, that's great. If I can't, we need to do something else. If I've got a little bit of time, like, yeah, it's not rising, but they're not precipitously falling either. The first thing I would probably check is see if we're acidotic. Cause if you're real acidotic, norepinephrine is really not going to work. And you're going to need to give something like vasopressin, or you can correct your acidosis usually with a bicarb bolus or something like that. So that's always a good kind of, oh crap, things aren't getting better, what can I do? You can give an amp of bicarb. It'll correct your acidosis. It'll give you a nice little fluid bolus as well, and may help your blood pressure. But I think you got to look at reasons why your norepinephrine's not working. If it's not acidosis, then what's the problem? Do they just need a second agent because norepinephrine's just not, they're going to need so much, it's not going to get you there? Or do they need something like inotropy? Or something else? Like, do we need to correct other things like calcium or, like I said, like bicarb?
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is a good cognitive stop point to really ask what you might be missing. Is this not distributive shock? The best tool, other than just your brain, I think, is ultrasound here.
Yeah.
100% of these patients probably, I'll be looking at their heart, make sure we have reasonable contraction on both sides. Get some rough idea for their volume status. The IVC is not a very sensitive or specific tool, but a totally flat IVC in a hypotensive patient, I'm probably going to assume is bleeding somewhere. Mm-hmm. Are there signs of obstructive physiology, whether it's tamponade or a blown RV or like a tension pneumothorax. You got to rule this stuff out. Probably in anyone who's in shock, but certainly when they're not responding the way you think when you're treating them for distributive shock. And then, yeah, kind of metabolic factors, or is there a reason they might not respond? This kind of acidosis thing has been a little bit controversial, but no matter how you feel about bicarb, is in a really sick patient, I think it's probably worth a little bit.
Yeah.
A different pressor, yeah. A different pathway, certainly. You know, if you're using norepinephrine, maybe you should try vasopressin. Should you try phenylephrine? I don't know. I mean, that seems a little weaker to me, but or you know, epi certainly if you think that they need more contractility. And then, yeah, do they need calcium? I'll give almost all these patients a little. It usually does something. And occasionally you see a lot, and that's probably the ones who were low. You know, you need calcium for, you know, myocardial contractility. You need it for vasomotor tone. You need it for kind of everything that you want to be happening right now.
Yeah.
I think probably one of the most common correctable things, you know, at the end of your workflow here is just the patient is that sick and you haven't fixed them. But one of the more common ones is you're treating the wrong kind of shock. Mm-hmm. And this is really common when people get into habits, like certainly in a MICU, probably anywhere. Everyone assumes that everything is sepsis and they just throw on some pressors and they miss that this person is bleeding or this person, you know, is obstructed or whatever. Also technical stuff, right? So your pressors are not going in because your IV stopped working. Or even something wrong with your central line. Or your blood pressures are wrong because there's something wrong with how you're measuring.
Right, and that sounds dumb to say, but you'd be surprised how many times it is as simple as your vessel's not, or your IV's not in the vessel, right? Whether it's, you know, Norby's going into the floor or the bed, it could be that your IV, especially if this is somebody who's kind of rapidly gone into shock, maybe you don't have a central line yet, you're doing peripheral pressors, your peripheral might not be good. And sometimes that's tough to tell, right? You'd think it'd be easy, it flushes easy. But I've had times, especially with people who are very fluid overloaded, very big, with a lot of tissue, it's hard to see a puff up of fluid under the skin. It's hard to feel the resistance, etc. And then, yeah, like you said, how are we measuring your blood pressure? Do you have an art line? Is your art line good? I've had times where art lines are very positional and they will kind of go flat. But if you adjust them a little bit, you get a good waveform and find out that your pressure is actually a lot better than you thought.
Yeah, you know, anytime something is not happening the way you expect, you have to kind of ask what's wrong about your assumptions. And how do I put this? I think if the response or lack of response is immediate, it is usually a cause that's very proximal. So, you know, let's say you're kind of go up in your pressors and, you know, their response is kind of weak and they're gradually getting worse. That could kind of be anything. But if it's like you doubled their levofed dose or you pushed epi or something and there was no effect, that to me suggests that it's a very near problem, like no drug entered the patient or the drip is dry or like turned off, something like that. You know, you have to kind of work your way through the chain of causality here. But my guess is going to be that it's something very near on that chain because it's such a complete, you know, lack of what you expect.
The other thing I will say, when you mentioned pushing a dose of pressors, so I've had this happen before. Push some pressors, nothing happens. Push it again, nothing happens. Third dose, you see this, start to see a response. And it turns out when we put the echo on, the guy's ejection fraction was so poor, right, that he's just not circulating the drugs. And so that should, again, you know, maybe this is more than just septic shock. Maybe it is septic shock, but maybe he has, you know, people can have two things, right? So you can have somebody who has underlying bad heart failure with an EF of south of 30 or 20, even 20%, who's now in profound septic shock, and you're pumping pressors into them and they're just not getting, because their cardiac output is so poor that they have such a long circulation time that the drug's just not getting distributed very well. It's just sort of sitting there. So that may be something to look at too.
Yeah. Circulation time is not something we talk about much outside of anesthesiology, but it does take a finite amount of time to, for blood to get from any part of your body to another part. And if you're pushing drugs into a peripheral IV,
yep.
it's going to be a lot longer than a central IV. And you know, one good reason to get, make sure you get an ample flush behind it, certainly. Yep. But okay. Let's say you are trying to do an echo. You're trying to get a look at a heart for any of the reasons we talked about, and you can't get a window. You just can't see the heart. What are your moves here?
Oh, man. This is like an everyday occurrence.
Every day.
The ones that I seem to have the most trouble with are parasternals. We have, here in Kentucky, we have a little thing that causes a lot of problems in that everyone over the age of 6 smokes or works in a coal mine or something like that and has lung disease. COPD is sort of just, we take it for granted a lot of times. So, you know, we say, you know, what other problems besides COPD do you have? And so it does make it insanely difficult sometimes to get parasternals. So my first thing is just to try a different window. Go to the apical, go to the subcostal, something like that. If you're still having trouble, then you got to get to the fine adjustments. Can I get anything? Can I see any motion? If I can, great. Okay, now I'm going to make fine adjustments up and down a rib space. Usually sometimes even before I go up and down a rib space, I will fan really deep to see, like, if I fan down, do I get slightly better picture? If so, then I probably need to go up a rib space. You know, if I can get something resembling the heart, even if it's a really off axis view, then it tells me a little bit about maybe the heart's displaced a little bit. You know, I've had people who their heart is directly under their sternum or displaced far to the left. And so it doesn't show up where it should. So maybe by just manipulating my probe around to see if I can improve my view, even if it's not a good view, it's just a better view than what I had, that tells me maybe the heart's in a different location than what I previously thought.
Yeah, the chest seems small until you try to find people's heart on ultrasound. And like it could be anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, the hyperinflated...
Yeah, you would think it's always right in the left side of the chest.
Yeah, the hyperinflated lungs are always a challenge, and I agree. I kind of break up the classic views, parasternal long and short axis, an apical four-chamber, and a subxiphoid. The subxiphoid and apical are kind of lumped together because you're trying to look kind of up from underneath, and the parasternals from the front. And often when one pair of those is difficult, the others are a little better. So difficult parasternals, usually a really expanded chest like a COPD patient, kind of a fluffy lingula kind of trying to get in your way. But that heart is squished right down against that diaphragm, and you may have a beautiful, you know, subcostal window. So just trying any of those. Now, can you position the patient? Maybe. You know, most patients are better viewed kind of leaning, you know, laying on their left side a little, leaning forward a little. A lot of our patients are too sick to do too much of that. But at least you can make sure your patient's not, like, wedged to the right or something.
Right, yeah.
And then I think being open to using non-traditional windows, any view you can, you know, we're not taking pictures for the National Geographic here. You're just trying to answer some questions. And if you can get any glimpse of the heart, even if it's a view with no name, then that you may be good. So, you know, if you have to look from, you know, you can use subxiphoid windows that are other than the traditional, like, four chamber. You can turn 90 and get a short axis from there. You can slide kind of along that no man's land between a subxiphoid and your apical, that kind of the left half of the costal margin. Sometimes you can get some kind of a view in there somewhere. Not always, because, you know, the stomach is in there and that air may get in your way. But if your heart is in a weird spot, you may be able to get some kind of an in-betweeny view that you're never going to brag about, but you can answer your questions. I've had windows that were right over the midline. I mean, anything you can kind of muster.
Yeah.
This is not like a fashion show here, you know, or just, it's a lot more of, if you can get anything, if you have some experience and you have the pattern recognition, you can often answer basic questions.
Yeah. And that's a good point. If you have experience, right? Because I think it does become much more difficult to make solid judgments about heart physiology if you have a sort of non-traditional or poor view, right? If you have an apical four where you can really only see the left ventricle, part of the left atrium, and part of the right ventricle, it's really hard to tell if you're foreshortening or not. And so what you think may be, you know, maybe even like a Takotsubo picture, could just be your poor window, right? So I think that if you're really new to this, something is better than nothing, but just be cautious about making big judgments if you're not 100% sure what you're looking at.
Yeah, you're right. You might not even be able to recognize structures if right. they're not in their traditional places. And yet, you know, quality verification is always a bit of a challenging thing, but all the more challenging when the overall quality is poor, to be able to recognize that, yeah, you didn't cut that chamber right down the middle or something like that. I agree that it gets a lot harder.
Yeah.
All right, let's see, a couple more things. You're in a cardiac arrest, and you're seeing VFib, or maybe VTAC, unless maybe you have a different answer, but and every time you do a rhythm check, you see it, and every time you shock it, and every time it's still there, it won't break. You have an approach to this?
But you're sure it's VFib?
Well, I guess that's a fair point. I mean, you think you might have the wrong... someone left the electrode off or something?
Well, but I mean, if you have really fine VFib, it can look like asystole and vice versa. You know, you can shock asystole. It's not going to get you anywhere.
And I think there may be a... like, the difference between very fine VFib and asystole may be a bit moot. Like, I don't know that you can convert... really fine VFib, you know,
right.
Asystole has activity. Some, you know, it's
right.
It's not like pure flat lines usually. You know, that's like you did leave the electrode off. I think there's a bit of a spectrum there. But
yeah, well, the first thing I think I would do is check your equipment, right? So are your pads actually connected to the patient? Right. Again, sounds dumb, but sometimes we throw pads on and then patients are very diaphoretic and they've kind of sweated them off. Make sure they're in a good place, right? Are they ideally, I think you want them anterior and posterior, right? We do the whole upper shoulder and lower chest, which does technically cross the heart. But I think data shows that anterior and posterior is going to give you the most bang for your buck. So try that. I'm assuming we've already tried increasing the joules.
What's your approach here? Do you just like max the thing out always?
Typically, or? Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people just shock at like whatever the default in the thing
just
is.
Go big or go home, right?
Like, even ACLS says like do whatever the instructions say. I mean, who's read the instructions for the defibrillator?
Yeah.
But yeah, certainly if you're not converting a shockable rhythm,
yeah,
you know, max the thing out there. No, I agree. Pads are not uncommonly a problem, I think. They like routinely will start to come off from just compressions if something is anterior. And then you have this thing that's like half adhered. And you know, the machine tries to, you know, make up for the increased impedance from like bad contact, but it can only do so much. Like if your thing is mostly air, you start to like smell burning hair and stuff. I mean, new pads maybe
I was gonna say, swap the pads. I've seen people I've not really seen this with VFib, VTAC, but I've seen it with trying to cardiovert people, applying pressure to the pads. So typically, when I've seen this done, you kind of roll up a towel, put it on the top pad, and then someone will literally sit with their fist on it, pushing it against the chest, and they're semi-insulated by the towel. I've never done this because I'm afraid of electrocuting myself, but I've seen it done several times. And I think I used to work with a cardiac surgeon who always used the paddles, like the old school, you know, like on TV where you slap them together and smear the goop clear, you know. He always used the paddles because he thought they made better contact. So that's something maybe to try.
Yeah. No, we had a code not long ago where the pads were absolutely not sticking. And I did manual pressure just to get some kind of, I rolled up some towels. I like triple gloved. Paddles would have been a lot better, but we don't have paddles anymore.
Yeah.
But you could see, I mean, of course, in most cases, pads are just make more sense. Everyone can stay far away. You don't have to keep putting them on and off and stuff. But if you can't get them to stick, and there is this area where they're sort of stuck, but maybe better would be better. You know, paddles have that benefit of being able to put direct pressure on there, regardless of, you know, if their skin is wet or sweaty or flaky or all burned off or whatever. There's something there. You know, the other stuff other than thinking about correctable problems. Is this really just a matter of you couldn't get it to break? And there's a whole kind of pathway or realm here of ventricular storm or electrical storm, and people have tried all kinds of stuff for this. The most common you might see is double sequential defibrillation, mm-hmm. which is putting a second set of pads on, you know, next to or near your first, and shocking with usually two devices you need relatively simultaneously. Usually it's done kind of one then the other. There wasn't a lot of data for this, although it was somewhat widespread, mostly in the pre-hospital realm, I found. And then just a couple years ago, there was finally an RCT that seemed to show people have, you know, a little more ROSC in this situation when you do this. So I think there's enough data that it is probably worth trying if you can make it happen. You do need another defibrillator, another set of pads. Short of that, you could do what in that study they also tried, they called vector change, where you just move the pads, mm-hmm. you know, different spot, if you can't figure out. But I will say that there are some defibrillators that can be damaged when the circuit is open if you double the current. So you could avoid that by not shocking absolutely simultaneously. You know, count down from three, you know, one person pushes one at one and the other pushes at zero or something like that. It doesn't take long, but people have tried beta blockers like Esmolol. All kinds of weird stuff, but it's a difficult situation. All right, let me ask you maybe one more. You have a patient, let's say they're on the ventilator, maybe not, but let's say on the vent, they have a OG or an NG tube and you're giving them tube feeds. But the nurse comes and they're like, listen, I checked their gastric residuals and they're really high. Now, whether they should be checking the residuals is another question. It's become less common, and maybe there are times they should or shouldn't, but whatever. They checked them, and they're high. And if it matters to you how high they are, you could tell me that. But otherwise, what do you do?
I don't think it matters to me really how high.
If they bother to tell you, it's high enough.
I think, like you said, the first question is sort of why are we checking gastric residuals? I would check to see if we – do we know where the tip of the tube is, right? Is this something that's post-pyloric, in which case your gastric residual should not be high, right? But I have seen this before where we have a peripyloric or even gastric small bore feeding tube where they're getting fed and an NG tube, and the NG tube is hooked to suction, sucking the tube feeds right back out. That's an easy fix. Stop doing that. So I guess I would kind of want to know a little bit, you know, what prompted you to check the gastric residuals? Do they have any symptoms? But if ultimately, if it's just too high, I think my first stop would be to just pause tube feeds for a little bit. Let's give them some time and see how things go. Maybe shoot a KUB just to make sure there's no obvious obstruction or anything that's preventing them from moving stuff along. But I think the first step would be just to give them a break.
Yeah, the whole backstory here, why we're talking about this, is that the data such as it exists and now guidelines from groups like Aspen is to just not routinely check these because checking is not associated with anything positive, such as reducing risks of things like aspiration, and is certainly associated with giving people less nutrition because whenever you get these high numbers, people end up holding it. You generally are supposed to check if there are concerns, like the patient seems like they're getting very bloated or they're vomiting or complaining or something like that. And some places have protocol where as they're initiating feeds, maybe you check for a while or something like that. But I do think that in general, the message is residuals are probably just not as big of a deal as we thought. So I think you should not sweat it much unless it's probably higher than you would have thought. You know, well over 400 or 500 cc's probably. I mean, you know, if someone's like, there's 350, it's probably just ignoring it is the answer, probably. Mm-hmm. Is there a number that's too high? Maybe, but it's who knows what. I agree. You troubleshoot your various things. And if I really just think this is a motility problem, I'll sometimes try some kind of a pro-motility agent, metoclopramide, erythromycin, something like that. I think those work pretty good for gastric motility. If the problem is distal, like they have an ileus, then I don't think it works. But hopefully in most cases, we already know about that. And if, you know, maybe if they have an ileus and you want to try feeding it, we should be feeding them very little, just like a little trickle, in which case, hopefully you're not getting a lot of residuals unless it built up over the past 2 days or something. But yeah, there certainly are people where there is a problem here that can be identified with residuals. It's probably a minority, whereas, you know, this is data that many times is probably, like a incidentaloma. Like it's a weird looking number that if you didn't know about it would never have been a problem.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, when I first started as a nurse, I worked in a hospital and we had these cardiologists who would tell us all the time, you'd call them with critical labs And their response would be, stop checking those labs. And I used to think, how irresponsible that is. And now I look back all the time and go, man, yeah, we should not have looked at that. Because it's just going to cause everybody distress.
Yeah. Yeah, and the point is not that the getting data like that could never be useful. It's that it's confusing more than it's useful.
Right.
The harm outweighs the benefit.
Right, right, yeah.
All right. Well, maybe we can call it quits there. A nice little roundup of not uncommon situations and how a couple of medium intelligent people tend to handle them. A lot of this is not a right answer, you know? It's just having some kind of a bag of tricks to respond to things, like we're talking about, just having some kind of an approach that maybe plan B will work, maybe plan C. I'm not saying B has to be better than C, or maybe B was better than your plan A. It's just having more than one option is generally better than not. We'll just remind all you good people, if you have not checked out the Intensive Care Academy, our subscriber-based video school, then it may very well interest you if this sort of thing does. It's over at ICU101.com. We've got an entire orientation program for new critical care providers, as well as a growing library of specialty material for the MICU, a whole bunch of procedural stuff that's been rolling out the last few weeks, and we have some neuro and surgical and other specialty material on the way. So check it out if you haven't. I think it'll appeal to you, and otherwise, we'll talk to you next time.